Oral calendar this morning is Smith versus Kesson. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel. If you'd like to use that time for rebuttal, please be mindful of those timing restrictions. They're indicated in the light and clock in the podium in the middle. But I'll point out that we provided three different microphones with a preference that you use the microphone that's closest to you because of the ongoing medical circumstances. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of who's making which argument in the audio recording that we'll publish after the argument. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may. I was going to suggest that you use the microphone that's closest.
Oh, you want me to?
Yes.
I thought I heard that, but then everyone else is using that one.
I know. That's because the presiding judge is just not on his game today. So
I apologize.
I care more for you two than the other lawyers, and so that's the reason.
We won't tell them that. May it please the court. Oh, I'm sorry. Are we ready? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
May it please the court. Jack Perry from the Taft Law Firm, and with me is Scott Flaherty, also from the Taft Law Firm, and we're here on behalf of the appellants, Ron Smith in the far corner, and his wife, Diane Aves. And the overarching issue we have, we've identified five, we believe to be five reversible errors, but the overarching issue is, has Mr. Smith satisfied his statutory burden of clear and convincing evidence that his visitation with his two grandchildren would not interfere with the parent relationship with the same children. And I believe that to get to those five reversal errors, this court simply needs to look at five determinative facts.
Mr. Perry, before you get into that, I have a standard of review question. Your brief seems to suggest that we can look de novo because the decisions were made based on affidavits. That strikes me as a bit unique in the sense that this, as I look at the record, they were essentially the parties agreed to submit affidavits, and the cases you're citing are pre-evidentiary cases of prima facie basis. I'm assuming, or I was under the assumption, that here we would consider the matter as an abuse of discretion like we would any other trial. It happens to be the party submitted the evidence based on affidavits, and this is both the first order, as I recall, and then as well as the subsequent order, which is maybe the more direct one on review. Is it true that the cases that you focused on for de novo are those preliminary custody modification type prima facie basis? That's not our situation here.
Well, you may have noted that even though we began saying it's de novo review, we essentially argued in the brief as if it's abuse of discretion standard. So we tried to cover both cases, but or both bases. But I'm not sure that this isn't de novo review, and that it is true that the parties all agreed to submit the evidence on the affidavits. They did not, and our client certainly did not agree to a deferential standard review, which would be a completely different deal.
Would that be required? So what I'm getting at is, for instance, a custody modification case, and we're now at the evidentiary hearing, and the day before the hearing, the parties all tell the court, we don't need a hearing, we're going to submit all the evidence via affidavits and other agreed-upon exhibits. The judge makes a decision. I assume we would still use the abuse of discretion standard of review in that scenario. Notwithstanding, we can look at all the same exhibits that the judge did, but the judge still has that deference.
The one case we found that supports your position, which may be right, is in the footnote, and it's the Boland v. Martha case, which supports exactly what you're saying. It's different context. I would submit in the family law context, particularly when we're looking at visitation, it is very, very difficult for me to say it is fair to give deference to the judge's finding when there's not only not live witnesses, there's no Zoom witnesses, there's nothing else.
So we would then weigh the credibility weigh the evidence on our on first impression?
You are in the exact same position the district court judge is.
Right. Where have you, were you able to find any case law
right.
that supports the idea that this court would undertake a fact-finding?
Right. Right. Unless the parties agreed, and they could have, but they were not asked to, and they didn't, say that we are accepting that this will be reviewed with a deferential abuse of discretion review. But
so
they
you
didn't
suggest
do that.
The parties get to determine our standard of review? Of
No. If they did below, if they had agreed that you can hear this on, and there are cases if, like, in the
why would the parties ever be in a position to have the authority to determine what our standard
I don't think they ever
is.
Would, Your Honor. That's my point, is that I don't think they would. They didn't in this case. They weren't asked to.
Right, so I guess, again, if the parties, I'm a little lost in your argument. So the parties submitted evidence in writing. The district court weighs the evidence. You're asking us to take a de novo review of the fact findings of the district court. Am I correct so far?
Correct.
Were you able to find any case law in which this court or the Supreme Court ever undertook a fact-finding, whether it's based upon affidavits or any other documentary submissions?
We cited two cases, Your Honor. One, the Ross case, this is on page 39 of our brief, and we cited the Greece case. But again, this is not a major component of our case at all, but because we believe that we win on the abuse of discretion. And the reason is there's five determinative facts. The first fact is that the Kessens twice contractually surrendered any interference concerns, both on May 24th, 2019, and August 22nd. They also, the second factual determinative fact is that the Kessens surrendered by pleading any interference concerns on April 3rd, 2020 with their pleading request for the enforcement of grandparent rights consistent with the August 22nd, 2019 mediated settlement agreement. Third is the most critical fact is that because the Kessens unilaterally curtailed and then cut off in the spring, basically March and April of 2020. All of the evidence that was submitted by the parents, which is submitted on May 19th, 6 weeks later, addressed alleged interference based on facts that predated either the two agreements or the petition or both. There are no facts pled, alleged, argued, that took place after they petitioned for, on April 3, 2020, petitioned for grandparent visitation by Mr. Smith.
Mr. Perry, the concept that I found unique, and so I want to ask you about this in a couple different ways, this concept of surrender of rights by contract, in this case the two, you're referring to the two mediated settlement agreements, and then surrender of rights via one's allegations in an answer to a petition. But I'm just going to reroute a little bit. I don't see that the judge analyzed either of those issues, but moreover, I don't see it was in your client's amended petition or even in the motion, and not at all in the motion, but in the first amended petition. And when I look at the evidence that was given to the judge, I don't see, or the memorandum, an analysis of that so much as what your client's main number one request was grandparent visitation. And so wouldn't we be precluded from considering a newly argued issue that wasn't to the judge didn't have an opportunity to respond to and analyze?
No, and I think the best support is actually in the opposition brief. Kessen's lawyer argues, doesn't deny that below, he calls it treatment of, we call it surrender, but he says below that both the contract, the May 24th contract and the August 22nd contract, and the pleading, both of those issues were treated, he called it treatment of, the initial pleadings, treatment of the contracts. There is no dispute that both the contracts and what they mean and the pleadings, their counterpetition, were argued below. And in fact, there's three spots in both our notice of motion, our brief, and the affidavit in the second motion. And three spots, both in there's two spots in the initial motion, and then three different spots in the motion for amended findings. So all three different times this issue was raised, both the contract treatment of and the pleading the treatment of were argued. And the Jacobson case from the Supreme Court said, of course, on appeal, the lawyers are going to argue differently. In this case, in defense of the trial lawyer for the Smiths, the concept of what do these agreements mean legally for this proceeding, and what does the pleading mean legally, is a difficult deal. We vacillated back and forth. Is it a waiver? Have they waived their claims of interference? Probably. We put that into our brief. Is it a surrender where they gave up that right? Is it an evidentiary bar to them re-arguing?
The reason, what I'm asking, I'll just describe it as a garden variety grandparental visitation request in terms of the evidence. I do see in the amended petition, I think request number two was to enforce the mediated agreement. But wouldn't, if the whole issue is simply enforcing an agreement, which I think is a nutshell of what you're arguing to us today, why would there have to be any evidence except for that mediation agreement, and then just make arguments to the court? And now you'd hit it on the head, but your client didn't do that. It was presentation of evidence in terms of best interests and non-failure to interfere with parental rights seemed to be the focus of the evidence, and then the court's findings and conclusions.
Well, here's the reason is that even though we have these agreements and even though we have the pleading, I don't think that ends the matter, because if there are actions after the two agreements and after the April 3rd, 2020 counterpetition, if Mr. Smith engaged in conduct that a reasonable fact finder could say is evidence of his potential interference, then those agreements are not dispositive, and the pleading's not dispositive.
And isn't that what the judge did?
No, he did the opposite. Is that I expected when I read the record that he must have found things after the contracts and after the petition that he relied upon. But as a matter of law, that is false, because we know that on April 3rd, they petitioned for his grandparent rights consistent with the August 22nd agreement. So at that point, on April 3rd, they recognized, and the In Re Perry case says that's their pleading. That's they said at that point, under oath, under penalty of perjury and acknowledgement, they argued or they represented that his grandparent rights, which they were petitioning for, would not interfere with their parenting rights. But the judge found opposite, and so I expected to find after April 3rd something changed. But we now know when we look at the record, nothing changed, because on May 19th, 6.5 weeks later, we have all of the evidence that is before you now from the parents, all talking about interference that had to predate the agreements and certainly the April 3rd petition, because there was no parental involvement with the grandparent or grandparent involvement with the kids between that 6.5 week time period. Does that make sense?
Is it true or is it not true that in the motion for amended findings, the post-judgment amended motion, there was no issue that you're raising here raised to the judge? For instance, that issue right there you're indicating is the judge made an error of law by considering new facts post the mediation agreement, or that the court erred in making a determination of enforceability. None of that was raised to the...
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. What they raised was they repeated, because if you recall, on May 4th, 2020, there was a case management order, and then there was an amended one the week later. And in paragraph 5, that case management order, the judge found there was no agreement, which is he subsequently reversed on February 23rd, 2021. But that was one of his findings. in his August 17th order. So his first order, the entire premise is off. There, according to this judge's finding, there was no agreement, and he ignored the pleading, the counterpetition pleading. And only it, because of the amended findings, was that corrected. But the entire argument was, and I like the words that the Kesson's attorney used, they call it the treatment of, what is the treatment of the agreements and the pleadings? And so though every single motion, every single brief, and every affidavit of Mr. Smith contained not only the agreements, but also the pleading, references to the pleading. It was front and center the whole time. The only thing that wasn't there, the only thing I would concede to your question, Judge Slider, is that they did not use the word waiver or surrender, or did not say it was a bar. They just said they agreed to this. They pled this. Okay, so the question is, under Jacobson, is that enough? And I submit to you, under Jacobson, absolutely it's enough. Otherwise, we have a concept. You know, what we know that mediated settlement agreements are enforceable, but how do they play into interference ruling? It's not the end of the story because they have a mediated settlement agreement. It's not necessarily the end of the story that they have a pleading, but those have to be relied upon, I believe the judge can only ignore those if there's subsequent facts showing interference. Because otherwise, what did the Kessens agree to? I'm sorry. Can I finish that sentence? Or
you may finish.
I'm sorry. I wasn't trying to cheat. I just didn't.
Well, the clock is all right. I understand the clock's off to your peripheral.
But in this case, you are correct. The contract and the pleading, they're dispositive because there was no evidence submitted of interference after that point. Thank you.
Thank you. And you'll have another 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yeah, I'll look at the clock better next time.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Jason Brown, and I represent Brian and Catherine Kesson. They're present here today. The relief that we are seeking by the court is in the form of one of three things: either an outright dismissal of some or all of the issues that have been presented on appeal, second, and the alternative, to disregard several of the issues that have been raised on appeal, and third and finally, to affirm the district court. Believe your honor, your honors, that a three-step approach will help this court answer any and all claims that are being raised by appellant in this case. Three-step approach. First, should this issue that is under consideration, should that issue have been appealed a year ago, following the district court's conclusion and order surrounding the motion for amended findings? Second, was this issue argued in appellant's second motion? And third, is the answer afforded by the district court relative to the second motion against logic and the facts in the record? Now, with regard to jurisdiction, the key is this. Under the Vanguard case, if time limits could be extended by simply filing a new motion, then the time limits prescribed by this court under its rules would be rendered meaningless. In this case, if we look at the first motion that was brought by grandfather, in motion number one, there was a question about treatment of the initial pleadings in this case. Grandfather sought relief in his motion for amended findings based upon the idea that he was entitled to some sort of notice pleading in this case. And the district court in this case denied that request. It denied it in its order concerning the motion for amended findings on February 23 of 2021. There was a vigorous debate back and forth about the implications of the initial pleadings in this case. And grandfather didn't appeal. There was a robust debate about the implication of this temporary agreement. Everybody agrees it was a temporary agreement.
Can I stop you there?
Yes.
Is that in the language of the agreements? I don't see any language about the term of the agreement or what could, when it ends.
The agreement itself on its face is temporary in nature. It speaks of a limited time frame, a time frame involving the summer of the upcoming summer when they met initially for mediation with retired Judge Manrique, and the second agreement about what was going to happen during the 2019-2020 school year. And it says nothing further. And you can read that agreement to reflect that for this fall, for example, there is an agreement that the children will attend a visit to a piece of property that grandfather owns in northern Minnesota. Second, and I think even more compelling than on its terms, grandfather repeatedly in his affidavits indicated that this agreement was only meant to be temporary in nature. And that's why, in fact, he sought relief above and beyond the terms of that temporary agreement.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Brown, can you respond then to Mr. Perry's point that arguments were made, I know this is separate from your jurisdictional issue at that first trial, or argued, I should say, in the trial that was submitted by written documents, that indeed the judge should enforce those agreements, that should be the order, and moreover this issue of surrender by pleading from your client and surrender by agreeing to the contract, I guess. Would you agree with that characterization of the arguments that were made to the judge preceding that first order?
In the first instance, yes. I mean, everything has a synonym. We can call it surrender by pleading, or we can call it let's debate whether whether grandfather was entitled to notice pleading and what the implications are of that. That was fully briefed. The two are synonymous. And the same is true with the surrender of rights claims. There was a vigorous debate about the implication of this agreement, what its meaning was, what its terms were, what its fallout was supposed to be. The synonym for that is surrender by contract. In 22 years of working as a family law attorney, I've heard neither of those terms presented to me in any type of a proceeding. They're new to me. But they're not new in the sense that they're not unique. We often deal with, well, what are the implications of pleadings? Surrender by pleading. We often deal with the implications of what's the meaning of a temporary agreement? Surrender by contract. The idea, Your Honors, that a temporary agreement, a staple in our family court system, could somehow be construed as a surrender of rights would shock the conscience of the family law bar. People agree all the time to do things on a temporary basis because temporary agreements serve as a stopgap. They serve to fill a void between the time that a family is initially in crisis and when the dispute is ultimately resolved. And those agreements, pursuant to the case law, in all sorts of contexts, whether it's custody, child support, orders for protection, spousal maintenance, the Crosby case, the Korf case, the Hines case, and so on and so forth, those orders serve simply to preserve order, and they are not binding on the court, and they can be modified at any time by the parties or by the court. So nothing in this agreement that is being alleged to have been a surrender of something suggests for one second that, as a caveat, the parties agree specifically that the Kessens waive their ability to claim interference in the grandparent or in the parent-child relationship relative to their grandkids. It doesn't say that. And if it did say that, we'd have a different debate today, but it doesn't. And so for this court to suddenly turn and accept their position that, look, if someone, anytime, anywhere, if they have an alcoholic spouse, if they have an abusive spouse, and they agree temporarily, well, you can have some parenting time, that does not result in a forfeit of the ability to claim in court that they have an alcohol abuse problem and they shouldn't be granted sole physical or legal custody or parenting time. It doesn't preclude evidence on the history and the notion of domestic abuse and its implications upon the children. That's what they're asking this court to do. They are taking a hard-edged approach to the meaning of a temporary agreement. Now, with regard to the other issues, I think this is critical. This court's rules require an appellant, pursuant to Rule 128, to specifically cite how a surrender by contract and a surrender by pleading argument was raised before the district court relative to the order that is subject to appeal today, the second motion. They were supposed to do that. They were supposed to say how it was raised and cite to the record. And they didn't do it. And they didn't do it because they can't do it, because it wasn't addressed relative to the second motion that the grandfather brought in this case. With regard to the merits, and this is really the undercurrent here, is this. The district court has made it very clear. With regard to a surrender by pleading type agreement, it is grandfather in this case who solely and exclusively bears the burden of proof. The district court said it wouldn't matter even if they had said nothing, the Kessens had said nothing. Grandfather still bear the burden of proof to come in and prove by a clear and convincing evidence standard that he and in a court-ordered visitation schedule would not interfere with the grandparent, or with the parent rather, parent-child relationship. He didn't prove it. He didn't prove it the first time when he said, my requested schedule should not interfere. The district court disagreed. He didn't appeal. He said the same thing, literally the same thing, the second time, a year later. Having an opportunity to spend time with my grandkids should not interfere with the parent-child relationship, the exact same verbiage. So what the court really focused on is the idea that he had a burden and he didn't meet it. And he didn't meet it because the record is very clear. There is a mountain of evidence that would suggest that there has been and predictably will continue to be interference with that parent-child relationship.
Mr. Brown, as you mentioned, your experience in family law, the issues aren't resolved regardless of orders that come out from the court, and including what order we issue. It does seem pretty clear the judge in both orders found a relationship with grandparent to be in the child's best interest, but it was that second prong, as you're pointing out now. And so, though not directly related to the appeal, I'm curious from your client's standpoint what you envision if we were to agree with your client and argument here and affirm the district court's order, so you still have a best interest analysis. What happens next in terms of possible contact with grandfather?
Well, I will tell the court that there have been efforts by the Kessens to reach out to grandfather. And many of those requests have fallen on deaf ears. Many of those requests have been ignored. Attached as Exhibit 6 to Mr. Kessens' July 5 of 2021 affidavit reflects that he sent an email to grandfather on March 9 of 2021. Extending himself and explaining that, look, this litigation has taken its toll. It's taken its toll on his marriage to his wife, the mother of the children, which, by the way, in and of itself, is reflective of the type of interference between a parent-child relationship that is at stake here. I don't think there can be any more serious consequence to a child than their parents perhaps splitting as a result of the strain and stress of repeated pounding regarding a desire to get grandparent visitation. Now, persistence on the part of grandfather is getting in the way of healing. It has been known from day one in a letter that is in the record from December of 2019 that I wrote to counsel for grandfather, that the way forward for this family, like so many, is not to litigate. It is to let people heal, it is to let people organically reconnect with one another, and it is to let time and nature take its course so that they can have meaningful relationships. The relationships are going to go both ways. I will say, they have continued to invite, they have continued to inform of activities, of sports, of different things, and none of those are good enough. We've mentioned in our prior motions before the district court, nothing ever seems good enough. And that's one of the things that really gets in the way of this getting resolved. Because just when we go to mediation and say, all right, let's try this, grandfather comes back and wants more. Just when we extend and say, let's do this, let's get you some extra time here, let's do that, and this is prior to all the motions. It's not good enough. We reached an agreement. They would go to the family farm in northern Minnesota for a nice weekend. We agreed the parents would go along. After the fact, grandfather didn't want the parents to go along. He wants more. He wants his way. He wants time alone with these children. And the fallout of that request, the fallout of that requested alone time with my client's children puts them in a position of being undermined. And there's a long list. I think what the district court had to say is that there is a detailed yet not exhausted list of examples in its court order. This is more than just the CDGD analysis that grandfather has brought before the court. They'd have the court believe, well, this is just a little hostility, a little acrimony, let's look beyond it. But the distinction is, this is not just people swearing at each other, right, or calling each other bad names. This is conduct. This is undermining
CDDG didn't just involve acrimony. I mean, it involved accusations of murder.
Okay. I understand. But the difference here is repeated ongoing acts that are bubbling up and percolating that continue to undermine the parental authority of my clients. That's the distinction that I'm trying to draw between this case and the CDGD case. The last thing I see, I've got about a minute left. I do need to point out, we didn't have a chance to reply, but the key position they seemed to take in their reply brief was that Sweef somehow conceded a whole bunch of facts because we didn't address them in our brief. They cite the Loth case. Loth, and it says this in their brief and it says it in the decision, an apparent exception to the rule is an uncontroverted statement in appellee's or respondent's brief. We're the appellee. They're the appellant. Loth doesn't apply. The Zulke case, same thing. The court misinterpreted the Loth decision by misciting the footnote. But then they say, well, if the facts aren't good enough, you also didn't address certain issues, and so we win. Not true. Peterson and BASF, those litigants were the petitioners in the case, or the appellants in the case. And the case law says that if they as appellant don't raise something in their brief, they forfeit it, not the responding party. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Jack Perry. I'm going to respond to, I think there's 7 points that I need to respond to. The first is jurisdiction. The district court found, based upon your decisions, prior decisions, that family courts are allowed to revisit issues. And in this case, he had multiple reasons to revisit it. We set those forth in our brief. On top of that, what was conspicuously absent is any reference to your decision in Lilleboe, L-I-L-L-E-B-O-E, Lilleboe, whatever, which addressed the second custody order, even though the first custody order wasn't appealed from, and did so based upon the entire record. The second argument is about this treatment of the agreements and the pleading. And ironically, despite arguing that we didn't preserve it before, counsel conceded that the treatment of the contracts and the pleadings was discussed with the first motion and the amended motion. It says it wasn't with the third motion. I cite you to the document 67 at page 2 of the motion. I cite you to document 68 at page 5, the brief. And I cite you to document 69 at 17, which is this Smith affidavit, all three talking about either the agreements or the pleading, or both.
Mr. Perry, just to clarify, and Mr. Brown brought this up and in the briefing too, that it was in the record, there's no disagreement but for the fact that those two mediation agreements were temporary.
Well, let me read that to you. That's going to be my third point, so I'm going to jump right to that, okay. If that's okay. Is both the May agreement and the August 22 agreement, which were signed by all the parties, and it was before Judge Manrique, a former Judge Manrique, so it was the best possible mediator you could have, made sure everything was done right. How does the agreement end, the first paragraph of the recital? The parties' respective attorneys shall convert this agreement to the requisite format required by the court, namely stipulated findings of fact, conclusions of law, order for judgment, and judgment and decree.
You're reading from the form language on the...
Yeah, but they've all signed.
Wouldn't that be not address the issue of the parties agreeing in their own minds that it was temporary? So reduce it to a temporary order, I understand that. But I guess what I'm getting at is if the issue is forefront to the judge or raised to the judge on enforcing an agreement, wouldn't the judge first have to make a finding as to whether indeed this was a temporary versus a permanent agreement?
If you read the term of the August 22nd, there are terms that go well into 2020 because it talks about not only parent visitation during the school year, which would go all the way until May, and then school, the summer visitation. So this was temporary in that, you know, wasn't a permanent visitation schedule, but it went all the way through the next summer. So this entire school year and the next summer, that was prepared for. And so that means at the same time that they are arguing on May 19th of 2020 that they're not fit and they will interfere with our parenting, the agreement they signed had already allowed visitation with them on a schedule that we all agreed to. And to prove that point is paragraph 2 of their counterpetition says, enforcing the terms of the binding mediation agreement attached hereto as Exhibit A. That's August 22nd. They're asking the district court judge to enforce it, and that's April 3rd. Well, you can't enforce something that's, if you accept their argument, that it's not enforceable. It's a temporary agreement, it's not enforceable. And then what do you do about Chapter 518 about mediated settlement agreements, which the statute, the legislature says, they're enforceable? It is an enforceable agreement with the obligation signed by counsel, both counsel, to convert this into a permanent agreement between the parties.
Well, to convert it into an agreement between
the parties. That's right. Can I make one last argument that we haven't touched upon at all?
I think we're gonna we'll rely on your briefs for any additional argument if you wanted to raise it. This point.
I will just say that the number one issue here is the conditions could have taken care of it, and Exhibit A shows those conditions, as do Exhibit the agreements and the pleading show that there were conditions, which this court has said multiple times, conditions.
Thank you. The matter is submitted, and we'll take it under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory period. I'm sure because you're both outstanding lawyers that you will advise your clients that a victory in this court or in the district court is a nice win. A better victory would be if the court doesn't have to decide these things, but the parties can get together and figure things out. Nothing prohibits, as you know, your clients from getting together before we issue any opinion and sorting this out in the best interest of the children and the relationship between parents and grandparents, parents and mother and father. But what we'll do, because if we don't hear otherwise, is we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Somebody's gonna win, somebody's gonna lose.
Message received, thank you.
Thank you. That is the last argument on our oral calendar this morning, and therefore the court is in recess. Thank you, have a good day.